Welcome to the Global Heart Podcast. I'm your host, Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Foundation. Today's episode, we have a fantastic topic. It's all about Mendelian randomization. That is a method that is increasingly being used in cardiovascular research. And also, I'm very happy that joining me as co-host is Dr. Raul Santos. He's the Editor-in-Chief of Global Heart, researcher at the Albert Einstein Hospital, Associate Professor at the Heart Institute, University of Sao Paulo, Medical School Hospital. Welcome, Raul.
Thank you very much, Pablo. Hello, everyone. It's a real privilege to address you on this podcast from Global Heart. And today, as Pablo said, we're going to discuss a very interesting technique because nowadays there's a huge demand for identifying new risk biomarkers for cardiovascular disease, but also future targets of therapy. And I think this Mendelian randomization technique that has grown very wildly over the last years, I think is quite complex, but quite interesting and quite robust. And for that, that's why we need to do a podcast like this to really enlighten our readers, because we as clinicians sometimes have lots of difficulties in understanding what it is, what are the power that this technique has, what are the limitations, and how to really translate that to our clinical practice.
Yeah, indeed. And we are receiving, in fact, a lot of Mendelian randomization papers. And you will see, I mean, for the audience, at the below the podcast, there are two links. One is a paper that is by Sanne Peters, who is one of the deputy editors. It's about general concept of Mendelian randomization, and also an example on the relationship between immune cells and lipids. We might be talking about these. But importantly, to help us unpack what Mendelian randomization is, when it should be used, and how to interpret it, we have the pleasure to have Dr. Jiao Luo, postdoc at University of Copenhagen. Jiao is an expert on Mendelian randomization. She's also the deputy editor at Global Heart, and she handles most of these submissions. So we are very happy to have her on this podcast. Very welcome, Jiao.
Thank you, Pablo. I'm very delighted to be here to discuss one of the most important topics in causal inference, Mendelian randomization, with the audience.
Yeah. Okay, let's start, Jiao. So I will start with a very general question. What is Mendelian randomization and why it has become so popular in cardiovascular epidemiology?
Well, Mendelian randomization is a very powerful epidemiological method for causal inference. So principally, it uses genetic variants as a natural experiment to test whether a risk factor is likely to cause a disease. So the idea is that the genes we inherit from our parents are randomly allocated, and much like the randomization of drugs in a clinical trial. And some of those genes make people have, let's say, slightly higher LDL cholesterol, and therefore the population is laterally divided into groups with different LDL levels. And by comparing these groups, we can ask, do those with genetically higher LDL go on to have a higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease? If yes, that's a strong evidence or a strong hint that LDL truly causes cardiovascular disease. It has been exceedingly popular over the last 10 years in cardiovascular research field because it helps answer big questions where trials are difficult or expensive, or sometimes it's even not feasible due to many reasons. So in short, I think it gives us more confidence about which associations in observational studies are truly causal, and therefore, which are the best targets for therapy.
So one thing that when you talk about, let's say, LDL or lipids, for me, it's easier to understand. But sometimes Mendelian randomization is being used for things that are not biological signals. It could be alcohol intake, for example. So when you're looking at exogenous factors, that is where it's not straightforward the first time you come across Mendelian randomization. Can you explain how you can look at even exogenous exposures to Mendelian randomization to understand some of these associations, for example, like with alcohol?
Exactly. So if it's alcohol consumption, usually we have different phenotypes of alcohol consumption, what's the frequency, what's the amount, the quantity, and so on. So when we are talking about alcohol consumption, first we need to define whether we are talking about the frequencies or the actual consumption, the amount consumed of alcohol. And the genetic variants are actually proxying the tendency of drinking alcohol. So it's not about like LDL or the levels, and it's about an individual could drink more alcohol or could be a frequent drinker. So it's very difficult at the first time to understand, as you just mentioned. But imagine those variants, they have this function in addiction. So some people carrying those variants, probably they are more addicted to drinking more alcohol. So biologically, it makes a lot of sense. People with those carriers probably during their lifelong time will have a higher amount or frequency to drink alcohol.
Okay, so it's genetic factors that influence on average at the population level who drinks more or not. So because that has been randomly allocated, if you want, the genes, you can look at that without confounding. So I think that's a good example. And alcohol has been widely studied for my Mendelian randomization. But I know that there are some, and I'm sure people can read these papers that are the link in Global Heart to go in more detail. But if you can just walk us through some of the core assumptions. So I know that you need to fulfill certain assumptions in order to do a Mendelian randomization study. Can you explain in the simplest possible way, which are the core assumptions that we need to take into account for a Mendelian randomization study?
Yeah, of course. There are three core assumptions in addition to several other assumptions. So let's still take the example of LDL and the cardiovascular disease. And the first assumption is the relevance assumption, which means that the genetic variants used as an instrument must be robustly associated with exposure. So in this case, a variant that actually raises or lowers LDL cholesterol levels. And the second assumption is independence. And that means those variants should not be linked to any confounding factor. And the confounder, we know, is a common cause of the exposure and outcome. So in this case, let's say obesity is a confounding factor between LDL and cardiovascular disease. And therefore, the variants we selected for LDL should not be associated with body mass index. And then the last core assumption is the absence of horizontal pleiotropy, meaning that the genetic variants should affect the outcome, in this case, cardiovascular disease, only through the exposure of interest, that is LDL, and not through other ways. This is what we call horizontal pleiotropy. And these assumptions matter a lot because if they are violated, the causal inference breaks down. So, for example, if a variant affects both LDL and the body mass index independently, then we can't be sure that the observed effects on cardiovascular disease is really due to LDL. So the strength of the or the reliability of MR depends heavily on how well these assumptions are justified or tested.
Okay, that's an important, very important point to when we read all these new papers on Mendelian randomization. So over to you, Raul. I would like to ask you, what are the most common mistakes that you've seen when Mendelian randomization is used or when it's being interpreted? I mean, what would be the most common mistakes you came across?
There's a very strong example of two papers on Mendelian randomization that associated vitamin D with the greater risk of cardiovascular events that were published in the European Heart Journal and the Lancet Diabetes Endocrinology that were retracted because of mistakes in interpreting the data. And as Pablo said, not only in our journal, but actually most journals in the world, we're really receiving tons of MR papers. And sometimes it gets too complex for us to really interpret the findings of the study. And sometimes it does like that. So what the author's done was not correct. So, yeah, I think it's extremely important that maybe you could tell us a little bit about the limitations and the possible pitfalls that we might have on this technique, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about whether I should take this vitamin D for as an example, because it's particularly addressed the nonlinear association there. I'll mention the linear assumption, everything here, but let's say how deep we want to go with that part. Yeah. So I answer this in two aspects. First is how MR is kind of misused. And the second is how it's misinterpreted. And one of those pitfalls I often see is a weak instrument that is use genetic variants that don't strongly predict the exposure, which can bias the results. And then another one is the pleiotropy violations, as we also discussed in one of the core assumptions. Often we assume genetic variants only affect their outcome through the exposure we are studying. But genes are not as clean as we thought. They are kind of messy. And the variant linked to LDL cholesterol might also affect other phenotypes directly. And that will invalidate our causal inference. And another one is population mismatch. That's a huge but underappreciated problem, because most of those genetic instruments are discovered in Europeans. And if we apply them to other populations, let's say Asian, African, or Latin American, and we often fail to find or validate the results we saw in Europeans, because the genetic architecture completely differs among this population. And finally is the linear assumption, because in general, the Mendelian randomizations gives the average effect on a linear scale, but the biology is often nonlinear. So the genetic variants might capture effects extremes that don't represent what happens with typical interventions. And the other aspect of clinical interpretation, I think most important point is we shouldn't ignore the effect timing. Because Mendelian randomization tells us a lifelong average effect, but most of the clinical interventions actually happen over weeks, months, or longest years. And this genetic effect of no LDL cholesterol, let's say, from birth, might look very different from lowering LDL cholesterol with statins at 50 or from 50 later in life. And another one is at the same time, we shouldn't over-interpret those null results, because clinicians often think, okay, if this MR was negative, so the drug probably won't work. But maybe the genetic variants just didn't capture the right biological pathway, especially for some biomarkers, those inflammatory markers where the genetic variation only explained a very small proportion of the genetic variability of this trait, or just the instruments were too weak. So in general, I think MR or Mendelian randomization is a very powerful tool for causal inference, but only under the premise that its assumptions are strictly tested and hold. And most studies would benefit from more rigorous assumption testing and the more honest discussion of their limitations.
That's great, Zhao. And I think I like in particular this was a question I always had about how relevant it is for other settings like Africa or Asia, Latin America, when most of you have European ancestry only in these studies, and you answer in a way that question. But I'll hand over to Raul to follow up with some questions.
Yeah, let's talk about the good things, Zhao. You gave us a nice example of LDL genes that raise or lower LDL and the consequent lifetime risk of cardiovascular disease. But can you comment a little bit about on inflammation? Because it was a very beautiful study made a few years ago from your hospital on CRP. We know that CRP is a marker of events, but not necessarily the cause of the event. And now we're developing many anti-inflammatory therapies that aim to reduce CRP, but not actually the lowering of CRP will reduce the events, but probably lowering of inflammation. So can you comment about this very nice paper by Tyberg Hansen and Bernard Vestergaard published many years ago that really changed the way we see inflammation in cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, I think it's more or less a game-changing point about CRP because it has been considered as a cause risk factor in CRP, but in genetic, at least in those very well-designed observational studies from different cohorts. But in the genetic studies, actually what they found was genetically predicted high CRP is not causally associated with cardiovascular disease. And this also explains why targeting CRP itself in clinical trials didn't yield additional cardiovascular benefits. However, even though it's not a causal risk factor, we couldn't deny that it could be a predicting marker. And we know that in long run, if a patient with cardiovascular disease has elevated CRP for a longer time, their prognosis won't be good. So while we acknowledge that CRP is not a causal risk factor, we should also appreciate that it could be a very good predictor.
I think it's very important to separate what is causal or what is a biomarker of risk. And definitely we have evidence from CANTOS, we have evidence from the colchicine trials that suppressing inflammation, and not necessarily suppressing CRP, right, will reduce the risk of events. Correct. I think other example that you gave that is very remarkable also is the one about HDL cholesterol, right? I'm a lipidologist, so having low HDL is no good, but doesn't mean that really raising HDL cholesterol will be protective. So can you talk a little bit about how Mendelian randomization helped us to understand a little bit better about this?
Yeah, I think actually one of the great examples in Mendelian randomization in cardiovascular field is actually HDL. Because for most of people, we have known HDL as the good cholesterol. That's also coming from the observational studies from very long time with prospective large cohorts in the US and in Europe. However, when we take the genetic variants that can increase LDL in the population and to conduct a very rigorous Mendelian randomization study, what we found was genetically predicted high LDL is not causally associated with future cardiovascular disease. That actually refutes the assumption that LDL or boosting LDL could have any cardiovascular benefit. And this is a little bit disappointing, but this is very much in line with the failed clinical trials previously. So I think, of course, there are still some trials ongoing to test whether elevating HDL could be beneficial in different populations. But at least at this point, all of those Mendelian randomization studies didn't suggest any protective effect against cardiovascular disease.
Oh, this is really nice. And actually, this changed a lot the way how we see HDL nowadays in clinical practice. And I have a question to you because you edited a paper showing the association of lipids with inflammatory cells, white, different white blood cells, lymphocytes, macrophages, etc. And can you comment a little bit about this paper?
I think this paper is at the right time to see how inflammation, lipids, and cardiovascular, or the interplay between all of them. And I think they use used large genetic data sets and careful MR methods. So the signals, in my opinion, I think are worth taking seriously. But at the same time, we have also to be modest because the immune system is not simply good or bad. So even the same cell type can act in protective or harmful ways depending on the context. Also, we can note that the effect sizes here are quite small, and Mandanaran and Malaysian can completely rule out this pleiotropic effect or separate nearby causal variants. So while this study actually adds weight to the idea that immune cells are part of the atherosclerosis story, they should be seen as hypothesis generation, pointing us towards to the mechanisms to test rather than a definitive proof of causality. Because of the effect size, as mentioned, is very small and the immune traits are hard to interpret. So the findings are based the same as biological plausible needs or as a strength and signals and not definitely proof of which immune cells are pro or anti atherosclerosis.
No, this is perfect, because I think my next question for you is regarding, because we are clinicians, right?
Yeah.
The audience of Global Heart, probably have some scientists that read us, but most of us are clinicians who do clinical trials or do epidemiological research, etc. And sometimes these very robust, overwhelming papers, I mean, the randomization to lots of variables, sometimes it's really very complex for us to understand and try to translate that into clinical practice. So my question to you is, what's your advice for clinicians or journal readers who come across these papers, but don't have, let's say, the full capabilities to really understand the value of this? And so how can you give a hint of, say, look, this is really good, this is robust, but we have some limitations here? Because one thing that you said about this nice paper that we published about the lipids and inflammatory cells is that the size effect is small. Okay, it's there, it's statistically significant, it's biologically plausible, but the size effect is small. And sometimes for us, it's hard to understand this, really how important the findings are, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a bit difficult to have an overview of all of those papers because of the mixed quantity. So for myself, I do have a kind of a checkbox when I come across a MR study. And first, we need to follow all of those assumptions stringently. So usually I will ask myself, did the authors use strong instrument? That is, using variants with very clear and robust effects on the exposure. And they often reflect the robustness by F-statistics. And if they don't show or report how strong their genetic instruments are, we need to pay special attention to that. And the second is sensitivity analysis, because within the Mandanaran randomization framework, there are several compensatory methods to test for different assumptions. And a good MR study should test for pleiotropy and other assumptions or other bias use a plethora of sensitivity analysis. And if you only see the basic results, be a bit skeptical. And then, as Raul mentioned, we need to watch for the implausible effect size. Because if the genetic effect is way bigger than what we see in trials or observational studies, there might be something wrong. Because most of the time, the trials focus on very short amount of time, but with larger effects, while Mandanaran randomization gives a lifelong time average effect and smaller effect sizes. And last but not least is we need to check the biological plausibility. And does this proposed pathway actually make any sense? Back to the paper we discussed before, because we know there are plausible biological pathways between lipids and inflammation. That also gives us more confidence that the association they identified is probably causal in the biological sense. And the bottom line is MR or Mandanaran randomization is just one tool in the causal inference toolkit. It's not a magic killing bullet. So the assumptions are strict and frequently violated, as we can see nowadays. But when the results point in the same directions as randomized trials or well-designed observational studies, and this convergent evidence actually gives us much stronger grounds for believing in a causal relationship.
Oh, that's perfect. I really like to invite our readers or listeners to read the paper of He et al., who is published now in Global Heart, and also the review led by Dr. Sandy Peters on Mendelian randomization, because definitely that can make a lot of difference for you to understand how we are nowadays on this field. Pablo, back to you.
That was really useful, Joe, because you gave us a lot of tools. And I think for me, at least not being an expert, this message that, yeah, it is a useful tool, but you need to be careful and look at certain assumptions that you gave us and also in the paper that I will mention, we have some tools. And also the concept of triangulation, that the MR is only one source of data. We need to look at the biological plausibility and also evidence from clinical trials, and it doesn't come all from an MR. So, a good way forward with some, I think, challenges, but also we need to look at other evidence. So before we finish, Jiao, because of the scope of our journal, we always ask our guests a simple question is, if you can share, what do you understand by global cardiovascular research?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And we should actually reflect that on ourselves more frequently. I think for me, there are two things. One is diversity and one is equity. And diversity means that most of our either genetic studies or well-established cohorts have been made predominantly in the population of European ancestry or in the US. But that means much of what we discover may not translate equally well to populations in the other parts of the world. And it's very important that our science reflects the full diversity of the world and sharing data sets that are inclusive or interpreting findings in different contexts. And the second is about equity, and that has always been the goal of our journal to make sure research addresses not just the big problems in high-income countries, but also the pressing needs in low and middle-income settings where the burden of cardiovascular disease is actually growing fastest. So to me, I think the global cardiovascular research means building more widely applicable knowledge that respects diversity in genetics and also in the environment, and that ultimately helps reduce inequalities and develop solutions that can benefit patients globally.
Thank you, Joe. And I hope at Global Heart, we are helping with that agenda, particularly diversity. We, in terms of genetic MR studies, we hope the listeners will submit interesting papers aligned with that. I want to thank you, Joe, again, for this very interesting talk. Raul, thank you for co-hosting. It was a very interesting conversation. To our listeners, thank again, as always, for listening, and please subscribe to the Global Heart podcast. And you have, as Raul mentioned, the links below the podcast about the two papers that we're publishing. Thank you.